Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. And coming up on the program today, a new study lays bare the cracks and resilience at the heart of South Africa's public institutions. A revealing new book unpacks Paul Mashatile's rise to political power. Should there be an age limit for elderly motorists on our roads, and why going automotive green could cost you more than you think? It's Friday, the 24th of October. The Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection has launched a hard-hitting new book. It's called The State of the South African State. It's important, and it's a sweeping assessment of the country's institutional capacity, governance, ethics, and developmental strength after more than 30 years into democracy. Now, the study paints a complex picture, a state that has achieved major gains in service delivery, but here's the caveat, now struggling under the weight of what many say is weak leadership, also fiscal pressure and eroding trust. So let me try and pull all of that together. The director of research at the Institute is Dr. Sandy Africa. Sandy, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's start with this. How serious is the gap, in your opinion, then, between the state's constitutional promises and its actual capacity to deliver right now?
Jeremy, thank you for the opportunity. It's really huge. And as you say, we are faced with great complexity. The state, and by this I mean the study, actually acknowledges the role of all the institutions of state, from the local, provincial, national structures of government, but also legislatures, also the judicial and criminal justice systems, as well as the administration, a huge administration, having to service 65 million people. It functions effectively for some, but for others, the majority, one would dare to say, there's a sense of disappointment in the state's delivery. And so from the point of view of those for whom the state is expected to provide the infrastructure to access opportunities and to live a quality life, it certainly is the case that there's a gap.
It's interesting. You describe the state as complex, marked by crisis and resilience. And that's an interesting dichotomy. What does that duality look like in practice?
In practice, it looks like a state that really has multiple interests pressuring it to deliver, from class interests to demographic interests to geospatial interests, if one can personify those. So within the boundaries of the constitutional framework, there are multiple mandates, requirements, and expectations, duties, and responsibilities of the state. But at the same time, it's struggling to prioritize, it's struggling to deliver, and it's struggling to ensure that there is national consensus about what all of these should look like. And so, in a sense, there's this. The state is inanimate, in a sense, but there are very subjective elements that ought to be enabling it to do what it needs to do. Leadership, elected leadership, appointed leadership, a civil society peopled or populated by people who ought to have their fingers on the pulse, but this isn't always happening, and therefore the complexity, the crisis, the glass half full, but certainly also a glass half empty.
I find it very interesting that you flag technology as a key enabler. And I think there's a general understanding that in many aspects we are behind the curve. Where do you believe that digital governance could make the biggest difference right now?
Well, firstly, we have to acknowledge that not everyone has access to digital technology. And so whatever the state does, it should be careful not to increase the digital divide. But there are some interesting things happening in schools, in the education system, in some of the government departments. And I suppose it's a question of, in a way, amplifying the successes, but at the same time ensuring that the necessary infrastructure is there for people to access services. Sometimes simpler methods are better than digital if the population is going to be alienated as a result.
You also talk about restoring, and I quote, the moral and professional core of the public service. Where do you think the rebuilding needs to begin?
Interestingly, apart from the fact that the rebuilding needs to begin in the way civil servants are recruited and brought into the system and mentored and developed and trained, for example, through institutions like the National School of Government, which obviously can't do it on its own, needs to link up with universities and institutions that can help to build the skills base and in turn make the public service a place that is attractive as an employer to people coming out of higher education or out of school. So, yes, there's a role for the formal institutions, but I think there's also a role for the political classes, political parties and civil society and institutions outside of the state to actually educate people through civic education, through ensuring a better quality of people who get into state institutions. All of these could contribute to better delivery by the state.
And just a final one, are you optimistic after the publication of this report that we are maybe at the juncture of some kind of moment or renewal, or are we at risk of further institutional decline? What's the broad assessment here?
The broad assessment is that the state, being as fragmented and complex as it is, possibly required, and this is one of the recommendations that comes through from the study, a pilot agency, which, if the state is to play its role truly of being a developmental, we talk a lot about the developmental state, but in actual fact, we're missing some key components of what typically makes up a developmental state. So if the state was able to reorganize for effective state delivery through streamlining mandates, strengthening the center of government, but at the same time improving intergovernmental coordination, professionalizing appointments and the like, it's possible that we could really catalyze the turnaround, which is starting to happen. But at the same time, there are all the other gremlins and problems which need to be attended to at the same time. So very strong central coordination, but at the same time, room for devolution and decentralization so that where the need exists, people actually start to see the change.
The study is called The State of the South African State, and I've been in conversation with Dr. Sandy Africa, Director of Research at MISTRA. Sandy, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, a new book by investigative journalist Peter du Toit, titled The Dark Prince, lays bare the rise of Paul Mashatile, tracing his three-decade climb through the ranks of the ANC amid factionalism, alleged patron networks and controversy. And the big question it poses, should Mashatile be president of South Africa? And if he is, what kind of era might that usher in? It's an important book and an important debate. And we're joined now by Peter to dig into what his book uncovers and perhaps more importantly, what it means for our country going forward. Peter, in the book, and welcome Welcome to you. You say that Paul Mashatile, the deputy president, has, and I quote, navigated corruption and factionalism. What best illustrates that modus operandi?
Hello, Jeremy, and thanks for having me. Look, Mashatile has been at the center of various patronage and concentric networks of patronage for years. And he's always been a degree or two removed from outright allegations of corruption. But I think latterly, the best way in which to illustrate that is the fact that he lives in two multi-million rand mansions in Waterfall, north of Johannesburg, and one in Constantia in Cape Town, which has a combined value of 65 million rands, paid for by his son-in-law, who has in the past received quite significant largesse from the Gauteng provincial government when Mashatile was MEC in that government. So it shows that he's, the way in which he organizes his life, arranges his life, his personal life. There are a number of other examples of, as well, where his personal life is supported by people around him, where they pay for stuff. People around him pay for stuff like cars for girlfriends, like restaurants, lavish dinners, so on and so forth. He's very close to Edwin Sodi, one of the country's premier tenderpreneurs. So he finds himself in the middle of these networks of patronage, and he often and regularly benefits from those networks, Jeremy.
But how does he stay removed one step out of the orbit, so to speak?
For example, when in 2017, 2018, he was a regular visitor to a very exclusive and upmarket restaurant in Johannesburg in Melrose Arch called the SA Wine Bank, where you had to pay a membership fee. You had access to some of the top wines in the world, top chefs. And he was a regular visitor there, but he never, ever paid a single bill as far as our investigations are concerned and as far as we've been able to ascertain. It's always been paid in cash by people around him. A guy like Paul Murane, who was a businessman and a former ANC mayor of Johannesburg, was someone that was known to foot the bills for these lavish dinners, lavish lunches. So you won't find his name on an EFT. But what it does show you is that these networks, these patronage networks, individuals that often and sometimes rely on state contracts for their own personal progression in life and wealth, you know, are the individuals that keep on funding the lifestyle of Paul Mashatile. And that's the problem, Jeremy. We saw this with the rise of Jacob Zuma 20 years ago, when he was beholden to interests outside of the national or the public interest. And I fear that we're seeing it coming to the fore again with someone like Mashatile.
In fact, Peter, you warn of a possible Zuma 2.0 moment. So what would make that real, and what, if anything, in your opinion, could stop it?
Jamie, I do think that Paul Mashatile is the undisputed front runner to succeed Cyril Ramaphosa as the ANC's leader. The ANC's next national elective conference happens in 2027. At the end of this year, we've got the midterm conference, the so-called National General Council, which is normally the ANC gathering, which is considered a coming out for prospective candidates. And I think Mashatile is far and away the front runner to succeed Ramaphosa. There's really no one else at this stage that I can see that is A, either challenging him in the moment, or B, that has the wherewithal, the resources, and the backing to challenge him in future. The names that are being mentioned is someone like Fikile Mbalula, Nomvula Mokonyane is another name that's being bandied about at the moment. But no one really has the depth of experience in the ANC, the ability to work branches, and the ability to corral support in a national conference type setting that Mashatile has. So that's where we're headed at the moment. And when you talk about a Zuma 2.0 moment, I do think that Mashatile comes from the patronage network tradition of the ANC, comes from Gauteng, which, as we know, is riven with corruption, with extraction networks. And that's the tradition where Mashatile comes from. He subscribes to that type of politics, where you see public resources being extracted from the public purse, being recycled and reworked back into the party. And I think if we see Mashatile becoming the ANC leader, I really do think that we're going to see a Zuma 2.0.
So tell us then why a potential presidency of the country should matter to ordinary South Africans, and where your concerns are.
The big challenge for Paul Mashatile, of course, is if and should he become ANC president, he's going to have to arrest the electoral decline of the party. There's a very real chance in future that the party might dip even below the 40% that it did receive in the last general election. But if the ANC remains the largest formation in a government of a coalition government, we've got the government of national unity, of course, at the moment, then there's a very good chance that he might become head of state. And Jeremy, then all these patronage networks, also exemplified by his main network, which is the so-called Alex Mafia, which has been around him since the mid-1980s, will move with him to the union buildings. And if history teaches us anything in this country, is that the years of state capture, when we saw the private and vested interests of people like the Guptas, when those vested interests attaches its claws to the union buildings, then you see the large-scale extraction of resources. And I think there's a very real fear that we need to take note of, that should Paul Mashatile ascend to the union buildings, we might see a repeat of the years between 2009 and 2018.
And do you think, and a final question, those forces are starting to gather, whether it be in a secretive or opaque way? Is he starting to think about shaping ANC power structures and moving towards a more direct challenge?
Undoubtedly, when he was elected deputy president in 2022 at NASREC, his aides and his advisors were very clear in explaining to the gathered journalists that he wasn't beholden to anyone, and he wasn't beholden to Cyril Ramaphosa, that he had the ability, and that he did corral enough support amongst branches to be elected off his own bat. Over the last 18 months, certainly, it seems like President Cyril Ramaphosa has given Mashatile enormous exposure and given him some responsibilities that Ramaphosa didn't even have when he was deputy president under Zuma. So, for example, he's in charge of intergovernment or relations between partners in the GNU. He's head of the so-called clearinghouse, which is supposed to manage relations between the different constituent parties. He has conducted official visits to Japan, to Russia, to France, to the UK. He's been an envoy to London to go and see the high priests of capital at the merchant banks and the ratings agencies over there. So it's almost been a coming out of sorts over the last 18 months as a statesman, and within the ANC as deputy president and as a former acting secretary general. He knows the party machinery inside out, and that is a massive advantage for anyone who sets his sights on the party leadership, Jeremy.
The book is called The Dark Prince. It's the unofficial biography, I guess, of Paul Mashatile, and the author is Peter de Toy. Peter, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, a national debate is heating up, I read, over whether South Africa should introduce an age limit for older drivers. Now, supporters argue it's about road safety, while critics say it risks being discriminatory and maybe even ignores the fact that many elderly or older drivers remain safe and responsible behind the wheel. So is this good public policy or ageism in disguise? I'm going to talk about that with Bobby Ramakhwede, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Automobile Association of South Africa. Bobby, a very warm welcome. So why is the question of age limits for drivers suddenly gaining traction?
Jeremy, I'd imagine that that's coming up and becoming a lot more topical because of the concerns that cognitive abilities may be eroding with age. That said, however, there is still room for a lot of research to be done about whether it is indeed the case, as opposed to a blanket rule being applied.
Do you know whether that research is underway in South Africa right now?
We're unaware of cases of research being done in South Africa. There are other countries that have trialed age-based programs, but South Africa's research is yet to be published, if at all it's being done.
But I'm assuming that the Automobile Association would support such research if it were to be undertaken.
We support the research, but I think in addition to that, the research should be considered to the extent that whatever findings it presents we create solutions that don't leave the elderly worse off than where they are currently.
Let's talk about other solutions in just a moment, but I'm just wondering, Bobby, if there is any current data which might illustrate whether the role of older drivers in road accidents is a thing or not.
We too were looking for that data. In fact, when we came across the articles, the first thing we asked was, is there evidence of a spike in accidents amongst older drivers? What was the cause? And is there a real reason for us to be isolating them as a cause for concern on the roads?
Now, many countries require medical or vision tests after a certain age. Again, you'll have to educate me here. Does that happen in South Africa? And would that be something that might aid the process, do you think?
I'll start by answering the last question. I think it is something that would aid the process. And in addition to a vision test, a broader spectrum of cognitive tests could be introduced. Some countries do have implemented the practice of introducing medical examinations after the age of 70 or 75.
For older drivers who rely on their vehicles to maintain independence, I guess due consideration has also got to be given to the human and even the social consequences of restricting licenses. Again, as you alluded to a little earlier in our conversation, it's a tricky and complex matter, is it not?
It is. Let's be honest. Taking a driver's license away from an able-bodied elderly person reduces their independence, and it also erodes their ability to autonomy and mobility. In so doing, unless there's a backstop or a solution, i.e. free public transportation, then we're doing them a disservice.
The other issue, of course, is a stricter testing regime should something like this come into effect. Surely, Bobby, it would place additional strain on licensing centres around the country, which we know are also under a huge degree of pressure.
Correct. So if they were to introduce something like this, I think there are lessons to be learned from the Civil Aviation Authority. For student pilots, there is a medical assessment that needs to be done, and I think every year or two that medical assessment needs to be renewed. That assessment is conducted through a network of GPs, taking strain off of the licensing department.
What then is the AA's official position on this issue?
So our recommendation as the AA is quite simple. Let's get into the habit of ability-based testing. Regular medical or driving assessments can be introduced at a much later age, call it 70 or 75, as opposed to a hard cutoff deeming very able people incapable. In addition to that, for those who are aware that they've lost their cognitive abilities, the state could introduce a voluntary surrender program with incentives. The incentive that I'm thinking would be public transportation, but in order for that to be effective, we'd need far more efficient and effective and affordable public transportation. I'm thinking of the Rea Vaya network and potentially an opportunity for the Gautrain to come to play here, providing discounted, if not free, rates for those who have volunteered their driver's licenses.
And I'm just wondering, in the future, maybe a debate like this almost becomes spurious because we are seeing the advent of new vehicle technology or even assistive driving tools, which maybe would help extend safe driving years for older motorists. But again, we're a little behind the curve on that in this country.
Yeah, we are. We're quite behind the curve on alternate vehicles as well as alternate energy forms for vehicles.
So finally then, what do you say to those who argue this debate is less about safety and more about stereotyping older drivers? We're going to have to be very careful here with the nuance and with the language, surely.
I think there's an unintended consequence. There are merits for us to test cognitive abilities as the years go by. However, the unintended consequence of implying or applying a blanket rule is that it creates the stereotype, and it also perpetuates the stereotype that growing old is a bad thing, which has been proven to be completely wrong.
Well, from your lips, because as someone who might end up having to go through some sort of cognitive test, it's a very important issue and one that I will be following with a great deal of interest. Bobby Ramagwede, thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the Automobile Association of South Africa, and let's see how this debate plays out in coming months.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, this is an interesting one. Electric vehicles, as you would have seen, are creeping onto South Africa's roads, maybe a little faster than we realize. But behind the smooth acceleration lies a far bumpier story, I read. There's new analysis from PPS Short-Term Insurance, and it really peels back the marketing gloss to reveal the real costs of the EV revolution. What am I talking about? Well, potentially higher repair bills, complex insurance structures, and a repair ecosystem that isn't quite ready, the study says, to meet the demand. So joining me now to discuss the numbers and the implications is Tandinani Mbeli, Executive Actuarial and Risk at PPS Short-Term Insurance. Tandinani, insurers then are pricing EVs differently. Is that because there is genuine risk there? Or, as I've intimated in the introduction, maybe the industry hasn't fully understood how to underwrite them just yet.
Thanks, Jeremy. Hello, everyone. I think both components actually speak to the pricing. So the industry, in terms of how wide repair networks can be, how quickly things can be repaired, the cost of those repairs actually does play a huge role. But with the industry itself, EVs in this country also being very new, a lot of insurers would be cautious in how the insurance is priced. And that's just as the time is needed to build up actual data, to build up the actual experience. So a lot of insurers might price more on the cautious side of things. So as I said, it's a bit of both. There is the genuine cost of insuring these vehicles, which is different to your traditional ICE vehicles. And then there's also just the understanding of the experience and understanding of the implications of having EVs on South African roads.
Which I guess begs the question then, how exposed would policyholders be when, say, a damaged battery would effectively total the car, even if it's a relatively minor accident? There would be concern there, surely.
Definitely, Jeremy, and this is why it's such an important point for policyholders to understand what is being covered under their policies. So the major thing, as well as we mentioned, there's a safety aspect when batteries are damaged in an accident for EVs, and this means that there's safety protocols that need to be followed. A vehicle may just need to be observed for many number of weeks, days or weeks, even just to make sure that there's no residual energy risk or risk of fire there that might happen. And then it may not even be a major accident, Jeremy, but it may be a major accident for the battery itself. So like the battery damage is quite substantial that may lead to total loss, which maybe in an ICE vehicle it would not have been the case.
So yeah. I wonder then whether current insurance products are reflecting the risk that you've just outlined, or maybe they're just being retrofitted in comparison to, say, traditional vehicle cover.
No, I would be fair to the insurance industry and say there is a fair amount of reflection of the actual risk for EVs. Obviously, we've looked at international data, which we may not have in South Africa at the moment as fully, but it is looking at international data, looking at trends internationally, and understanding the differences between EVs and ICE vehicles in South Africa to then adjust for the differences in those risks. So I will be fair and say there is a fair amount of reflection of the true risk, but there is that component of uncertainty. As I've said, the industry is still, the number of EVs on South African roads still relatively small. And so there is a period of gathering data that is needed so that the data will be more specific.
What I'm battling to get my head around is, if EVs are supposed to be cheaper to run, at least that's what we're being told, why are we seeing repair costs spiral? What do you think is driving that disconnect?
I think Jeremy, the bit on the repairing is repairs after accidents, for example, where there might be substantial damage, where the way EVs have been manufactured, there's a lot of parts that are quite unique and modular, so they might need full replacement as opposed to fixing. So I think what's happening is EVs will generally be cheaper to run and operate because there's fewer moving parts, and so there's fewer service needs, or the amount of service or the amount of work required at service intervals should be generally less than ICE vehicles. And then we also have the cost of fuel. If you've got solar at home, one could argue that's a lot cheaper to run those EVs. So on that basis, EVs should be cheaper to run. But when we look at repairs that might need to happen after an accident, for example, those will tend to be different from servicing costs for general running and maintenance of the vehicle. So there is that aspect to it. And we're also seeing, so that trend of cheaper EVs to run in the long term, I think we'll fully be able to be appreciative of it once the networks in South Africa are a lot wider and a lot more entrenched, and there's a lot more specialists and technicians that are able to do those repairs as well, and that will really drive down the labor costs and parts and everything else around it, that whole ecosystem.
I think that is some very useful advice. Tantanani Mbeli, thank you very much indeed. Executive Actuarial and Risk at PPS Short Term Insurance. I appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.